Today, while we're here, is Brick Cheney. His intro was, "I'm an attorney in that building over there." fantastic speaker, history buff, and he's here to share some of his knowledge about Paul Revere and what we can learn from there.
All right, thanks, Amy.
Thanks, Brick.
Okay, well, my topic today is on Paul Revere. I'm going to talk a little bit about him leading up to his famous Midnight Ride and a little bit of the aftermath of that with what happened at Lexington and Concord. Paul Revere is part of our American mythos, right? He's a iconic figure, and everybody, when you're a kid, you learn the stories of him. And the story we often hear is his lone midnight rider, right? Telling to the world, the British are coming. Here's a statue of him in Boston. The statue was made by a guy named Cyrus Dowling. Does anybody recognize that name? If you're a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, he is the same sculptor who sculpted the angel Moroni that's on the top of all of our temples.
I didn't know that.
So he happened also to do a few Native American sculptures and Paul Revere, Boston. So if you ever go to Boston and see his sculpture, he's from Springville, Utah, Cyrus Dowling sculptor.
So Frank, when was that statue you referenced?
This was in the early 1900s, like 1920 era, I think. You can see in the background, that's the Old North Church where the lanterns were hung, part of your story. So these are fancy big words. They're not, I didn't choose them from the historical works on this guy. So Paul Revere, in the 20th century, he became this figure of controversy, right? You have these, they call them filiopietists. They're basically, that's the people who love the patriotic side of the story. They authenticate, they celebrate, they revere, Paul Revere, right? And then you have these iconoclasts in the 20th century who kind of wanted to just debunk his story. So a lot of history that you got about Paul Revere in the 20th century was trying to kind of tear it down to the point where there weren't many stories about Paul Revere that would show up in textbooks and schools. It was treated only very lightly. And it's unfortunate because, as we'll see hopefully from the presentation, there's a lot of interesting lessons we can learn from what he did. There was, until the 1990s, basically no formal, narrative historical book that was a full treatment of just him and his life and his ride that had been written for, there have been articles, there have been scholarly, research, there have been general books, but not one that just focused on him until the 1990s, which to me is astounding. And how we remember him is this mythic lone horseman, right, who's riding through the night saying the British are coming, which, by the way, he never actually said the British are coming. Anybody have an idea why he would never say that? The British were there, but he was British still, right? We hadn't had the revolution yet, so he considered himself part of the Kingdom of Britain still. But as you see, he very much considered himself an American, but he never said the British are coming. They called him the regular. The regular. Here's a picture by Grant Wood. He's the same guy who painted the American Gothic, the farmer balding with a pitchfork and his wife, right? And this is, again, you see this lone rider. It's like the sterile landscape. He's the only thing acting in it, right? And this is kind of how Paul Revere is remembered in our kind of American mythology, which, as we'll see, I think is maybe not the best portrayal of what actually happened. So let's talk a little bit about who he was. Here's a portrait of him. And just looking at this portrait, this was by John Singleton Copley. He's one of the famous painters in America in the Revolutionary period. Just looking at this portrait, what would you lean about Paul Revere? And what do you think? He's a silversmith. He's got his little silver pot here and some of his tools that he used. Yeah. Anything else?
Contemplative.
Yeah, at least he wants to appear contemplative, right? He's got this pose that he's struck, which is kind of an interesting thing. He was kind of a man of action, right? More than words. But he clearly wants to appear as a thoughtful thinker person, right? And certainly ideas motivated him. He cared about things. He's dressed pretty nice, but not super formal, right? Which also gives you a sense of his character. I think it kind of reflects who he is a little bit, as we'll learn. He was in the merchant class. He wasn't aristocracy or anything, or nobility, but he was fairly successful. He, just interestingly, from the words and the letters that they wrote, you can see how he talked. And you can get his Boston accent. You can still see the Boston accent. So instead of charter, they said chata, right? And this is, you get the old American has kind of faded away from the English. You can see that these are very American people and
he actually wrote?
These are words that you see in his writing, the way he spelled it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So then you can tell, and this is the actual word, right? So you can get a sense of how they were sounding things out, right? So instead of get, instead of marsh, mash, right? You can hear that Boston accent.
Oh, you sure can.
And then you can also see the American stuff, right? Faller, instead of follow, right? So this gives you a little sense of, yes, these people are British, right? But they're starting to cultivate a very distinct culture, and they are Americans too. His father was born in France. He was one of the Huguenots, left France to avoid persecution. He was a goldsmith, and you can see these are sleeve buttons, and very intricate, very skilled father, very skilled goldsmith. And he passed this trade down to his son, who became a silversmith. Here's something Paul Revere made. What do you notice about this bowl? Now, there's some wear on it because it's silver, and the silver is kind of decomposed a little bit over time. But the tarnish isn't Paul Revere's fault. But what else might you notice about this bowl? The writing's very elegant and intricate, right? He did a good job on the writing. For the details, for that intricate, elegant work, he paid attention to that, right? Just like his picture, he wanted to appear, he had nice clothes, right? And he wanted to appear thoughtful. But what about the bowl itself? Pretty plain, and it's a little lopsided, right? It's a little lopsided. So Paul Revere, you get the sense, the broad brush stuff he doesn't care about so much, right? He's a detail guy. He cares about intricacies of things, and you'll kind of see that in some of his character as we talk about other things. So people have mixed feelings about how good of a silversmith he was. This bowl was a bowl he made. Not just any old bowl, it was to commemorate the Sons of Liberty, who had decided that they were not going to rescind a letter they'd circulated that said to the American people, don't obey the laws that they've executed. So the Britain said, you have to rescind that letter. The Americans refused, and he thought that was great. So he made this bowl, which elegantly describes what happened, but the bowl itself could use a little. He was an entrepreneur, so he would get out and try to generate business for himself. One of the things he did as a silversmith, he was a dentist. So if you can read what he says here, he's like, Paul Revere would like to inform everyone who are so unfortunate as to lose their teeth by accident or other ways, that he still continues the business of a dentist and flatters himself that from the experience he has had these 2 years, in which time he has fixed some hundreds of teeth, that he can fix them as well as any surgeon dentist who ever came from London. So you already see the tension, not with other surgeon dentists trained in America, but with London, right? You see this little tension that he starts, this was in 1770, 5 years before the revolution, of how he feels as an American businessman, right? And he'll fix them in a manner that not only an ornament, but of real use in speaking and eating. I would hope that's what your teeth would be. And he was one of the very first forensic dentists we had. If you recall this famous painting of the death of Joseph Warren, one of the leading American patriots at Bunker Hill, Joseph Warren's body was among the many bodies at Bunker Hill, and they wanted to identify his body, and they couldn't do it. They couldn't tell who he was amongst the crowd. They got Paul Revere, who had worked on his teeth and saw the work that he'd done for his teeth and was able to identify him. So Paul Revere's maybe the first American forensic dentist. Here's another kind of indication to his character. This is his father, Apollos Revoire, his coat of arms, right? And then Paul Revere took it upon himself to change his coat of arms. You can see he has little use for this superfluous kind of leafy ornamentation. Instead, he wanted a lion on his coat of arms. And he's got this this motto that he added, which you can't really see, but what it says is pugna pro patria, which means fight for your country, fight for your country. So see a little bit about, again, about his character and how he feels about being an American. This also harkens back to what he did with the silver bull and kind of not worrying too much about the broad brush stuff. When the Boston Massacre occurred, Paul Revere, as a silversmith, could do silver plates that could then be used for printing with ink and publishing in newspapers. And there was a picture that had been drawn by an acquaintance and friend of Paul Revere named Henry Pelham of the Boston Massacre. And Paul Revere took that engraving and basically plagiarized it. And this is Paul Revere's engraving, right? So that's his friend's painting that his friend had produced and was and ready to publicly, you know, circulate. Paul Revere basically jumped him to the gun, took his same painting and published it all. So again, but did make some changes. Right, he did do some things that changed it from Henry Pelham. So he didn't care about the fact that he plagiarized it, but he did have a particular message to send. There's differences between Paul Revere's painting and Henry Pelham's that are interesting and show you a lot about Paul Revere's character. So if you look at the soldiers here, rounded faces and kind of stern looks, Paul Revere makes them more angular. And look, this guy's grinning, right? So he's sending, this is propaganda, sending a message to British soldiers are evil oppressors who love, you know, the violence that they do to us. He's got a woman here who, in the other picture, this is a man. But Paul Revere has changed it to a woman to make the appearance of we're the innocent oppressed. He has a Crispus axe. So the other painting had a Caucasian person here down on the ground. Paul Revere's got Crispus axe, who was actually one of the people who died, right? So he's appealing to the whole populace, right, to rise up against the British. And he's added some names to the buildings behind. Butcher's Hall is what he calls this building. And he's got, this is, you can't read very well, but it's Customs House, which is interesting when you think about the Tea Party and those Tea Acts and the Stamp Act. He was opposed to British customs. So these are symbols, again, of oppression, right? British are butchers. So he has this touch, he has this flair for detail and nuance for purposes of propaganda, even though he is willing to wholesale plagiarize the other artists. Picture who the other artist Henry Pelham was. Something that counteracts our idea about Paul Revere as this lone actor, he was actually did very little acting alone. What is most remarkable to him about, to me about him as I've kind of studied and prepared for this, was his ability to network. So if you took a list of like 250 people who are, if you take these seven organizations, there's these seven primary organizations where the patriots in America would organize themselves and meet to collaborate and decide what they want to do for the revolution. And you took a list of everybody who was in these organizations and just tally up which organizations they belong to. Nobody in Boston was in all seven organizations, or even six of these organizations. But there, and out of the 250-something people who are in these groups, which include things like the Boston Tea Party, right, and an enemies list from Britain for the American Patriots, 80% are only in one of these groups. Paul Revere was in five of them. And the only other person who was in five was Joseph Warren. So this gives you a sense he was very well connected. He was very engaged in networking with his fellow citizens to try to spread his message, right? Even somebody super famous like Samuel Adams, only in four of the groups. Paul Revere is more integral to this part of society than any of these other folks. So leading up to the Paul Revere's ride, you have these opposing forces. The commander in chief of all the forces in America was General Thomas Gage. And we have this impression of Britain and the Redcoats as like super oppressive, evil, domineering folks. But he was actually he was pretty fair-minded. He had the same opinions about liberty as a lot of the Americans did, but he was loyal to the crown. And in fact, what probably hurt him the worst in the lead up to Lexington and Concord was that he wasn't more stern and being willing to just go arrest folks and imprison them and stamp down their activity. He felt like, unless I have really good cause, unless somebody's actually come out and broken the laws, I'm not just going to arrest them to suppress their speech and their activity. So kind of worked against him. He was married to a woman, Margaret Gage Kimball, who was an American. And so far as we can tell from history, she was pretty well embedded in American values. And so she would lecture him a lot on liberty and the American position. So interesting marriage, but they love each other.
There's some rumor she was a spy.
I'll get to that, yeah. So on the American side, the leader is Joseph Warren, who's kind of really one of the, there's also Samuel Adams, John Hancock, some of the famous names. But in Boston, Joseph Warren was really, he's the other guy with Paul Revere who was in all of these organizations, and he's really kind of leading things. One of the other leaders who was also in a lot of these groups is a guy named Benjamin Church. Benjamin Church turned out to be a spy and a traitor. So something that was curious to me, leading up to Lexington and Concord, both sides pretty much knew everything about what the other sides were doing because they were both completely infiltrated by spies. So this is one of them. He's in the closest circle to the Patriots, and he was constantly writing to Gage about what was going on. So he ended up being imprisoned after the revolution started, and he died on a ship at sea a couple years later. So they ended up suffering for what he had done, but yeah, he was a traitor. So the Britain enacted all these intolerable acts, right, that we've heard about in school. And they, you know, kind of increasing taxes since the 1760s. Basically, there was really expensive wars, right? The French and Indian War and some of these things, the colonies that they wanted the colonies to pay for. Townshend Acts were the ones that really started getting the Patriots upset. And this was a duty, a tax on various goods. And there was so much trouble about these that the British enacted the Tea Act, which actually rescinded almost all the laws and taxes that they've imposed with the Townshend Acts and left just one on tea that they figured this won't be a big deal. Obviously it was a miscalculation because when the tea tax was maintained, that's when the Boston Tea. So there's these, and once the Tea Party occurred, then you come with the coercive acts. These are, we're going to delegitimize the Massachusetts legislature. We're going to quarter soldiers in people's houses. It's much more stringent. And so it's getting tough for the Americans. And one of the things that the British decided they want to do was seize all of the ammunition that these and gunpowder that all these colonies had. Yeah.
Looking at the Stamp Act.
And we still suffer
from the revolution.
Yeah, exactly. That's what the British were trying to do, is raise revenue to pay off debt from the wars they did. But we didn't want it. So gunpowder in a lot of the settlements was kept in arsenals that were like central locations. This is one that's still standing today. This is the powder house outside here at Cambridge, Massachusetts, or Somerville, Massachusetts. And this is where they kept all the powder from around Boston, their cannons, their muskets, their guns. And the British soldiers set off on an expedition to this powder house, which is up where that green dot is. And they snuck up there by boat and they returned by land. And they took all the powder and ammunition from this powder house. And it infuriated the colonies, infuriated them. Because some was, yes, their town's ammunition, some was the British ammunition, but people kept their own ammunition and guns in those locations too. So even before the Second Amendment was a big issue, right? So these people are very upset. One of the things they got upset about with the Intolerable Acts is that the British government imposed these judges. They kicked out the American judges, put in British and Tory judges that were loyal to the crown. So after this powder alarm, they put these posts up on all the lawyers' doors. Anyone and everyone on the bar that shall presume after this day to appear in court or otherwise to do any business with these judges from Britain shall assuredly suffer the pains of death. So pretty serious threat. Pretty serious threat. I think if you die, the pains. Yeah, all the Sons of Liberty would take this and post this on all the lawyers' doors. Yeah. So we lawyers have a history of being racist. So. Which one?
Just the post.
Yeah.
It's funny how the S in September looks normal, but you look at all the other S's throughout there, it look like F's.
Yeah. The lowercase ones, you know, they got their little fancy writing that still carries over to the post. Yeah. Interesting. And they capitalize bar and day. It's kind of weird, just their
but
formalities.
But in the pains of death, the S and pains
is normal. Yeah, it's, I can't explain. You have to talk to a business here to agree. Here's the F and then the S in business, right? Who knows? You'd have to ask a grammatical historian about that. So there's this guy, William Brattle, who was a lawyer, right? This is why they hated the lawyers. He was a lawyer, and he lived in this nice house nearby that powder house. And he wrote, the colonials intercepted a letter that he sent to Gage, where he was telling them, hey, the colonials are taking big cannons and gunpowder from this powder house, and they're hiding them in different places. You got to go get it. And that's why they sent the Ashman to go get the powder. And so the Sons of Liberty were furious with this guy. And they didn't just tap that thing on his door. They came to, like, tear his house down. So he had to leave. He went to England. He never came back. Sons of Liberty engaged in some pretty rough tactics with some of these folks. Paul Revere decided he's going to meet at this Green Dragon Tavern, and he's going to organize a group, networking again, called the Mechanics. Supposed to be just mechanics, but all they did was do intelligence on British operations. So Paul Revere says, we're never going to let one of these alarms surprise us again. So he's not acting alone. He's definitely in concert with other people. So the British next, after the first powder alarm, decide they're going to go up to this Fort William and Mary in Portsmouth and take the powder there because they're worried about it. So they start off in this boat, but Paul Revere beats them, rides 60 miles in one day to the fort, tells the colonials New Hampshire territory, tells them, hey, you gotta secure this powder and ammunition before the British do. So 400 militia from New Hampshire go attack this fort. We don't talk about this as the beginning of the revolution, but it's really the first act. There were six sick British soldiers in the fort. They fired a couple cannons and shot a couple muskets, and then the colonials stormed over the walls. Nobody got hurt. They took the captain, his name was Captain Poppin, they took his sword as a symbol of his surrender. So they took the fort. It hauled off like 100 from the guy he surrendered to and pokes him with the sword. He didn't kill him, he just cut him. That's really the first, and in return, he got hit with the butt of a gun. So that's the first blows, really, of the American Revolution. People don't talk about it, but it was. The colonials dispersed all the cannons. Nobody ever found it. He used it in the war. British tried again at Salem, and in this case, they come to a bridge. The powder house is on the other side of this river on the hill. The Americans, right as the British were coming up, they didn't do it in advance. They waited to taunt them until the British were up to the bridge, and then they raised the drawbridge. And that's exactly what they did. They just taunted them from the other side of this river, and the British are very frustrated. They didn't have authorization to shoot colonials, so they had to just sit there and try to negotiate. And this Reverend Thomas Barnard from Salem is the lead negotiator for the Patriots, and he negotiates this deal where we'll let the bridge down. He takes like 3 hours to negotiate this deal. He says, we'll let the bridge down, but all you guys can do is go straight to the powder house. As soon as you're done at the powder house, you have to leave. So, of course, in the meantime, they get out the powder house. So the British go over to the powder house, there's nothing there. Right? Just this kind of taunting, right? And the Americans did taunt. They tried to get the British to fire the first shot because they wanted the moral high ground. They would intentionally tease the redcoats and get after them because they wanted the first shot to be fired by England. So then we come to Lexington, and what happened here? So they start gathering intelligence. Again, both sides know everything that's going on with the other side. Thomas Gage had said, we want this, we're gonna go to, he sent out some spies on the roads, he decided he was gonna go to Concord. And he wanted it to be a super secret mission. So he told one of his highest officers underneath him, a guy named Lord Percy, he said, hey, I'm telling you about this mission, but you have to keep in the strictest confidence. And Percy says, absolutely. You know, they don't tell anybody, they don't even tell the soldiers who went to Concord what they were doing until they get to Lexington. So it's supposed to be totally secret. This is a couple days before the mission. And as soon as Gage tells this to Percy, Percy goes out into the street and some patriot says, you're not gonna be able to do what you want to do. And Percy's like, what are you talking about, what I want to do? And the patriot says, you're not gonna get that, stuff. Percy's like shocked that they know, right? And the reason they know is because Joseph Warren, the American leader, has a very special secret anonymous source. And it's in the highest levels of intelligence or high circles of the British forces in presence in North America. And he went to his grave, he never revealed who his anonymous source was. But we are pretty confident that his anonymous source was Margaret Kemble Gage, General Gage's own wife, who had told him. The reason why we think that is because she wrote letters to friends in England saying, like, I feel like I'm being torn in two. I feel like I'm being dismembered by these different winds of opposing forces. And after Concord, she was sent by Gage back to Britain, and they were estranged after that for a long time. So we're pretty confident that she essentially betrayed her husband to help save the Republic. So pretty tough woman in an amazing situation. Okay, so then we come to the famous story of the lanterns, right? Paul Revere did actually arrange one if by land, two if by sea, right? And he's got a friend, Robert Newman, who's going to go into the chapel in the North Church and raise the lantern. Newman lives in this house. The British, on the night that the Concord expedition went out, Newman's ready to go. It's about 10 o'clock. He knows he's got to go over to the church. And there's a bunch of British soldiers playing cards in his parlor downstairs. So he has to sneak out the back garden to go to the church. And this is actually one of the lanterns that he hung. And he did hang two. Paul Revere beforehand, and you can see, had crossed the bay, the Boston Harbor there to Charleston. You can see even today the Old North Church there. You can see while looking across the water, you can see that as a beacon when they hung the two lanterns in the tower. And Paul Revere had sailed in his boat across the harbor. There was a giant warship there, and there was a curfew on ships. This was about 10:30 at night, and all boats were supposed to be out of the harbor by 9 p.m. So if he had been spotted, he would have been immediately arrested. But fortunately for him, on that night, the moon was particularly weirdly, the full moon, we should have been able to see him, but it was low in the sky, and it was kind of shielded by some of the buildings. And so when he went through the harbor, he sailed super close to the boat, in the shadow of the boat, and was able to get across without being seen. At the same time, Joseph Warren sent another rider. This is William Dawes. And Paul Revere was kind of north, supposed to ride to Lexington from the north of Boston. Dawes was supposed to ride from the south of Boston on a different route. He wanted to be safe, Joseph Warren, to make sure he got the message through. So he sent Dawes by the south route, and Dawes was a tanner, you know, he tanned hides and did leather work, and he had to go back and forth across the British lines a lot for his business. So he was sent because he was friendly with the guards and could get through, and he did get through. Paul Revere starts his ride, right, from the north side of Boston. And they need to get to Lexington, which is about 13 miles, and then further to Concord, which is another about 6 miles. So Dawes goes through the south here, and he gets all the way to Lexington, but he doesn't really alert anybody else along the way. The only thing he does is in Lexington is Joseph Hancock and Samuel Adams. So his mission is, I'm just going to go warn those guys to get out of there, because the British are coming and they're going to be arrested. Paul Revere, on the other hand, does alert people all the way through. He ends up changing his route because beginning of his ride, he could see ahead, British were hiding behind trees. They were waiting to pounce and grab his horse. So he cut north and took a little bit different route, but he warned people all along the way. He met up with Dawes outside of this Menotomee, and they went to Lexington. They got to Lexington at a guy's house named Joseph Clark. He was a parson there. And they warned Hancock and Adams, and they decided to go into Concord. But along the way, they were stopped. So Paul Revere actually never made it to Concord, which some people don't realize. He was captured by the British soldiers. And Dawes, when they were captured, Dawes fled on his horse and was kicked off his horse and gave up. He was done for the night. His horse had run away, and he went back home. Paul Revere was captured and kept prisoner, but he was interrogated by the British soldiers, and he told them the truth. He told them, hey, I'm out letting everybody know. The militia's coming. You guys are in big trouble because there's hundreds and hundreds of guys coming at you. And the officers got worried, and they started hearing gunshots, musket fire. And they got really freaked out. And at one point, they heard a massive volley of gunfire. At that point, they said, we got to get back to our troops. And they let Paul go. So he got away. Prescott, this guy that they met in Lexington, Samuel Prescott, was also riding with Revere and Dawes from Lexington on. And he knew this territory. He was out at 1 in the morning, not as part of their effort. to alert the countryside, but because he was dating a girl and he wanted to, you know, he's courting her at 1 a.m. So they caught him and, or they tried to catch him, but he evaded the British because he knew the back roads and alleys in between the barns. So he gets away and he continues spreading the alarm. But he's an interesting guy. He's a young guy, he had a lot of flair. He was an interesting character, Sam Prescott. So Parvier, after he's released, he comes back to Lexington. And the big volley of gunfire that the British officers had heard, he found out was there were other riders out that had told Lexington, we haven't seen any British on the roads, we think this whole thing is a hoax. So all the militiamen in Lexington were like, we've gotten ready for nothing. And so their leader said, well, just fire off a volley to clear your muskets and then go have a drink in the tavern. So that's the volley of fire that the British officers had to go out. And when Paul Revere got back to Lexington, even though he alerted the whole countryside, the people at Lexington thought that nothing was going on. So in fact, they were almost taken by surprise by the snow. So this is what I think is very interesting about this whole effort. So we have this in our mind that it's a lone rider. But if you look, here's Revere, here's Dawes, and they got captured, and Prescott continued on to these other towns, right? But they're not the only riders. Every town they alerted other riders. And those riders alerted other riders, and those riders alerted other riders. So that in some places, some of the musket fire that the British heard were warning shots that some communities used so that they prearranged to warn other communities. So by this evening time, this is like 60 miles away, Ashby. But by the next morning, everybody in this whole area had been alerted by this amazing network that Paul Revere and the Patriots had set up. So by 1 o'clock in the morning, Lexington's alerted in these other areas. By between 1 and 3 a.m., you get Concord and all these other towns. And by 5 a.m., pretty much everywhere, and the rest was by 9:30 a.m. So amazing, amazing work back in the day before cars or vehicles really of any kind. Be able to alert the countryside the way they did. It tells you a lot about their ability to network back.
And they just tweeted.
Yeah.
That was my question, yeah.
So the British march on Lexington, and they had to change around their march because of a swamp. They march on Lexington. We have this notion in our minds that back in the day, our ancestors without electricity would go to bed at, like, you know, Lincoln Park. But the British ran into people all night long who were awake. So there's this widow Tufts at 2:30 a.m. who just tooling around in her yard. I don't know what she was doing. But she sees the British coming. She hides behind a water barrel. She warns her neighbor, Samuel Tufts, who Samuel Tufts had been alerted by these riders that came through, and he was pouring bullets that morning. So he went out. He was a captain of militia in his area. He got his militia going. The British captured some other people who were riding to Boston on a milk cart. They ran into some leaders of the, they ran into a tavern where some leaders of the revolution, Elbridge, Gerry, and some of the other people were hiding. They had to leave and run and hide in cornfields to escape the British. And they came to another home at this place called Foot of Rocks. The light was on, and that bothered the British. They didn't want people to be alerted, so they figured that was some suspicious. They went to the house, and a woman answered, and there was a weird smell coming from the house. And they asked her, like, what is going on? And she's like, I'm brewing some tea for my husband. He's really sick. And so they left her alone. But in fact, the weird smell was they were melting pewter to turn into lead bullets. And her husband was out. He was not sick. He was getting ready to fight. So the British captured some more soldiers. And by 5 a.m., they reach Lexington right before they hear this volley of the Minutemen in Lexington. So they're a little bit freaked out, too. They arrive at Lexington. Here's where the militia at Lexington, there's only like 70 of them. They set up. The British, their giant force, they had like 400 people in this initial force that came in, and they set up, and the militiamen are pretty worried. And the British officer goes up to them and says, you guys have to disperse. And the Americans say, okay, we'll disperse. But right at that moment, somebody fired a shot. We don't know if it was from the Americans or the British or somebody out here in the fields who was trying to instigate something, but a shot was fired. It's a shot heard around the world, right? And the British launch a volley. And the Americans, contrary to our tradition, really didn't get off. There's a couple people who got off a shot. Mostly they were already dispersing. They really got hammered. And this is today, this is the Lexington Common. You can see it's not a very big piece of land. And these points, this flagpole and this marker, are about the distance between the two sides. So very close. If you were Americans and you were looking out, the British would be right where that flagpole is. And this is the where the British would look, and the Americans would be right about here, so they're pretty close. Here's a picture in 1775 made after the battle. And you can see this is a very accurate picture. So you can see the Americans are just running away, basically. Nobody's standing and fighting, really. And the British are just launching a volley into them. That is pretty accurately what happened. But it changed over time in our mythos. So by 1830, here's another depiction. Not very good, I know, but you have people shooting back in 1830. In 1868, when we paint it, pretty much everybody's towing the line, right? And in 1886, we're standing defiant and shooting back at them. But that's not really what happened. That's not really what happened. We were running away. Now, about 7 people were killed and 9 wounded. We had a very small presence compared to theirs. But after Lexington, we reformed. And the Lexington militia and everybody else who was coming in was preparing to battle. Here's Concord. In Concord, the Americans set up on a hill watching this bridge, and the British were on the bridge. And the British, in the meantime, were in the town of Concord down here, actually getting the powder, and they got the powder. They were successful in getting a lot of the powder from Concord. The colonials had removed a lot, but the British got some. So if you're an American and you're looking at the bridge, the British would be right over there. And if you're the British, looking at the Americans, here you are staying on the bridge, kind of narrow space, and the Americans can spread out all along the countryside. So when the British saw them, they said, "We saw a large body of men drawn up with the greatest regularity, with as much order as less disciplined troops." So they were very well formed, and they launched a volley at the British, and they took the bridge, and the British retreated. So there were some British casualties here, but it's the British retreat on this day where the most casualties are. And we're running low on time, so I'll just speed through. The British leaders basically said, this is not an irregular mob. This is very organized, very disciplined troops who are fighting us, and they were very well trained, and their battle plan was, tactics were very sophisticated. So the British had to walk back on this little trail where the Americans could hide behind fences that looked just like this still back then. And you can see on this battle road, it would be a pretty formidable place to have to march through in single file with people shooting at you from there. And on the way back, they were 15 miles back, just circled completely by a moving circle of fire. And what I think is interesting about this is we have this notion, again, like the Lone Rider, we have this notion that there's lone farmers showing up one by one and two to participate. But it wasn't. Wherever there were attacks along the way, they were organized groups of militia in formation who were making a very organized attack. So this is a very organized, networked battle between the British and Americans, and the British took heavy. And they probably would have been completely taken apart except for a rescue group came to save them. Just in closing, a couple last interesting anecdotes. Some of the guys were too old to serve in the militia. People up to almost 70 served in the militia. Some of them were too old. There's a group in the town of Menotomee who were all over 70, about 6 or 8 of them. They attacked by themselves outside of militia formation, had a company of British, and the British surrendered to them. So these guys, 70 years old. This guy, Samuel Whittemore, was amazing. He was by himself. And in Menotomee, again, I don't know what the deal with Menotomee. There's a lot of really tough old guys in Menotomee. But he's 80 years old. He gets his pistol and his two pistols and his musket, and he takes on by himself from behind a wall a patrol of British soldiers. He kills like 3 or 4 or 5 of them. They get to him, and as they get to him, he shot both his pistols, killed 2 guys, 1 with each shot, drew his sword to fight, and then the British bayoneted him 13 times, 14 times, left him for dead. And the colonials came afterwards to pick him up, and he wasn't dead yet. They kind of saved him and took him to the house, but they figured, we can't do anything for you. You know, you've been stabbed 14 times. And so they left him there, but he lived. And he lived to be 98 years old. He lived 18 more years. So this guy we didn't have a Medal of Honor yet, but he's like the medal of all medals, right?
Wow.
This guy's amazing. So it gives you a little sense of, like, that's our patriot spirit, right? That's where we come from in America. So in conclusion, just quickly on the numbers, we lost about 50 people. The British lost 70 or so, and a lot more wounded. But more importantly, we won the battle of being able to get the moral high ground because we were able to tell the story that the British hurt us first at Lexington, right? We were dispersing, they shot on us. We had a military victory, and so it put a lot of momentum into the revolutionary movement. And Paul Revere ended up not doing much in the revolution. He didn't stay to be much of a soldier. He did end up supporting the Constitution and the new government. What he went on to later was making silver, he went from silversmith to making bells. So you still have his bells ringing in different parts of the country, still sounding the alarm, right, for the community. So this is, the main lesson I would say, though, take besides the spirit and the patriotism and the courage of these people, their effort to network and connect with others was really what allowed us to form this revolutionary movement. So a lot of important lessons we can.
This is the bell cracked.
This is not the Liberty Bell that cracked, yeah. But he does have some bells that crack. So thank you.